Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. I have 10 a.m. Before we get started, I would like to take just a brief moment of silence for the respect for the Houston Fire Department and the Perrington Fire Department, who both have suffered a line-of-duty death since our last meeting. So if you don't mind, I would just like to have us keep their families and their organizations and their communities as well, and our thoughts and prayers. So if you don't mind, just for a second, for a moment of silence. Thank you. Okay, we'll get started.
All right. Item number one, roll call and excuse of absences of any of committee members. All right, number one, Ty Pranton.
Here.
Danny DeYeer.
Here.
Michael Silva.
He is excused. He will not be here at this meeting.
Okay. Robert Van Dyne.
Here.
Robert Ainsworth.
Who is also excused. He is out of the country at the moment.
All right. Vince Abrego.
Here.
Daniel Anderson.
Here.
Antonio Ramos, I'm here, and Shane Parker.
Here.
Okay, great. Before we go any further, welcome. We have the biggest group that I know of ever to come onto this committee all at one time. We have as many new faces as we do old faces. And we also lost one of our most recent members, Daniel Buford, is now a commissioner. And before he vacated last meeting, we had elected him as the vice chair for this committee. So before we go any further, I think we need to address that to get that position filled so that for continuity purposes, because we have just done the election, we'd like to reappoint somebody into that position. So,
okay, so you're adding to the agenda to elect a new committee member?
Well, I guess I'll defer to you for guidance. If that needed to be an agenda item, it was an agenda item last meeting when we took the election, and if I'm not mistaken, now it's for a two-year term, and he was appointed at the last meeting to the vice chair, but he has since stepped off this committee and gone to the commission. So what latitude do we have can we appoint somebody, or do we need to have an election to fill that position?
The committee would need to appoint someone to fill that position, and just to make sure that there's no objection to adding that to the agenda, because this happened just recently, mm-hmm. There won't be a problem with adding it to the agenda as long as everybody on the committee agrees and there's no dispute about adding that to the agenda.
Okay, so we would just need a motion from the committee and
to
an
add
election,
it to the agenda,
a vote on that.
Kind of an emergency agenda item, so to speak.
Okay.
I'll make that motion.
So who are you motioning to appoint to that position?
Hold on, I think you got a motion to even go there.
To add it to the agenda.
Okay, so we have a motion to add the appointment to the vice chair position, adding that to the agenda. So I have the motion from Daniel Anderson. Do I have a second?
I second it.
Okay, Vince, I'm sorry, Antonio, seconded it. Okay, any discussions? No discussions. All those in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? All right, so moved. So now we have it on the agenda. Got it. Okay, so the formality. So now let's address that issue, if you don't mind.
Like to make a motion that we appoint Vince.
Vince Abrego at the vice chair. Okay, once again, I have Daniel Anderson making that motion. Do I have a second?
I second it.
Okay, Antonio seconds it. Any discussion? Anybody else want to discuss that? Okay, that being said, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, so Vince is now filling the term that Daniel Buford had, which began last meeting for 2 years, correct?
Right. Yes.
And we'll all be back on the same page then at that two-year mark for
reappointment. We hope so.
All right.
Yeah. So Vince has full fiscal responsibility now for everything this committee does. Well,
congratulations. That's all Vince's fault. Okay. Moving on.
All right. Item number two, committee member training.
All right. I guess that's me. So in the last 3 years, we've learned a lot through Sunset. It came out that we weren't operating properly with our committees. That led to a rule, and that's how we got to where we are today with some new members. So the law is that when you have new members, you have to do some training. So we've got a brief training PowerPoint here. We do the same thing with the commissioners when they come on. Now, the fact that two of the new members couldn't be here today, and then in 25 we add two more to bring this committee up to 11, there'll be four new members at the next one. So we'll have to do this again. In talking to Chairman Deere, we didn't feel that was a bad idea. It kind of helps everybody be pretty clear on how things work. So I'm just going to run through this. What I did hand out to everybody was a organizational chart. That's just for your reference, so you kind of understand how the agency's put together. And the people that really run it are sitting right here, Ozzy and Sammy. So obviously you're at the Commission on Fire Protection. So the governor appoints 13 individuals to serve as commissioners. And this is the breakdown. Two of those commissioners come from a recommendation by the Texas Fire Chiefs Association. Two come from recommendations from the State Association of Firefighters. There are two that come from the recommendation of the State Firefighters and Fire Marshals Association. And we have one certified fire protection engineer, certified arson investigator or inspector. In this case, he's both. And I apologize, I should probably give you the name. So the two chiefs are J.P. Steelman. He's the chief in Longview, and he is the presiding officer of the commission. The other chief is a new commissioner, Brandon Wade. He is the fire chief from Corpus Christi. The two career firefighters on the commission are Daniel Buford. He is a lieutenant and the association president in Bryan, and Michael Glenn, Fort Worth firefighter. He's also the 11th district vice president for the IAFF. The two volunteer members are Paul Hamilton from the Panhandle, and also we have Tim Smith, who's from the Panhandle. The fire protection engineer is Bob Morgan. He's with the Fort Worth Fire Department. The arson investigator inspector actually is Kelly Vandergriff. He worked for the State Fire Marshal's Office and serves here. He's also a volunteer fire chief in the Panhandle area. One fire instructor from an institute of higher education. Right now that is David Coatney. He's with TEKS. He's the director of TEKS, and he fills that position. And then there are four public members who are appointed by the governor's office. And currently we have Sue DeVillis, Chris Cantu, Michael Johnson, and Amanda Friday. And those are the public members. So there's 13 commissioners, one of the larger commission bodies in the state of Texas, but it encompasses the whole fire service and then the addition of some public members, which is important to Governor Abbott. And, we've got some outstanding commissioners. I believe, this is my own opinion, I've been around here 30 years now, that they're united in the direction they want this agency to go, and I'm grateful to have them. They're also my bosses, so I'll say something nice about them every chance I get. This is the mission of the agency. I'll let you guys read that. And essentially what TCFP does, we provide the oversight and the services to paid governmental fire service organizations. That number says 348. I can tell you we've added quite a few since then. We add about 60 a year, and that's been a pattern we've had now for 3 years running, so that number is probably over 400 at this point, if not a little higher. Training entities, there's over 403. I need an explanation with that. We have community colleges, or brick and mortar facilities that teach fire academies and teach other certification classes. We have online entities, generally private companies that are teaching fire training online. Then you also have fire departments who have their own training academies or the training divisions. So quickly what you figure out is some of the numbers are minutia, and I've always said that statistics don't lie, statisticians do. Well, we have numbers, and they'll confuse the hell out of you, because if a fire department, and I'm just going to pick the Austin Fire Department, they're a regulated fire department, but they also have a training facility. They're certified as both. So in those numbers, the Austin Fire Department counts as a government fire service. They also count in that count of training entities out there. So sometimes the numbers look bigger than what they really are, but at the end of the day we have a little over 1,400 regulated entities that we regulate. And then We have a total of 38,000, a little more than 38,000 certified firefighters across the state of Texas. But what's important to note there is that at least 15,000 of those, maybe a little more, are individual certificate holders. So I retired before I took this job. I became an individual certificate holder. Now, when I came to work here, they hold my certification here. But if you retire, if you leave employment, but you want to maintain your certification, you can. That puts you in that individual certificate holder. And where that's a little confusing is that the state law says the employer, the fire department, or the training entity is responsible for paying for your certification. When you become an individual, that responsibility is now yours. Same with the CE. The department's responsible for maintaining your CE and verifying you have it. When you become an individual, that responsibility shifts to you as the individual. So that's the numbers, a lot of numbers, and know that those numbers are very fluid. They change on a regular basis here every year. This agency gets its authority from Texas Administrative Code. That's Chapter 419. If you ever have any trouble sleeping, break out 419 and put it next to your bed or your chair, and you'll be asleep in no time. It'll take you about 6 months to get through it. But I recommend reading that and understanding it. Also understand that it has been written and manipulated by real lawyers, firehouse lawyers, and legislators for years now. So it can be convoluted and confusing. That's why we have our own in-house attorney here who makes it clear as mud when we're having meetings like we are today. So from that authority, the commissioners, this agency, has the authority to make rules or administrative codes. And so that falls under Title 37, Part 13 of the Texas Administrative Code. Hence, the rules that you'll be looking at today and moving forward all fall in the 400 series, and you'll see that. Every rule we talk about has a 400 number in front of it, and that's how we function. So the commission has committees. They have three standing committees. This is the Firefighter Advisory Committee. Today there are 9 members. As I spoke to earlier, in 2025, the commissioners agreed to add 2 members to bring that up to a total count of 11 members. You'll notice the other two committees are already at 11. Curriculum and Testing has 11 members. Health and Wellness has 11 members. So suddenly after January 1, we'll be consistent across the board. That's a first, along with a lot of other changes that have occurred. Each of these committees play an important role in what goes on here. The committees are the chief advisors to the commissioners. So the commissioners are making decisions of what's best for the Texas Fire Service. They rely on these three committees in their areas of expertise to make recommendations back to the commission on what direction they should go with new rules or rule changes and things of that nature. Health and Wellness is somewhat new, and what we will soon learn is how this will play out. The commissioners, when they get a request to address a rule or make a change, they will typically farm that out to one of these three committees to take a look at. And now with this third committee, Health and Wellness, I anticipate some of the workload that has always been dropped on this committee to kind of get shifted to Health and Wellness, but I think there'll still be a lot of intermingling. I see meetings of Firefighter Advisory and Health and Wellness together as we move forward with this, and I think that's all in the name of making sure we get this right. I think it'll be effective. Curriculum and Testing, I'll say this, and I came from Firefighter Advisory, Curriculum and Testing is probably the busiest and the hardest working committee of these three, hands down. They touch and have something to do with all the curriculum that's out there when it comes to the training. Test questions, test banks, the rules that go with that, the skills that need to be accomplished in that, and they do a bulk of the work. And so their meetings, unlike the other two committees, they're generally here for 2, sometimes 3 days. And any one of you are welcome to attend any of their meetings and see how that works. I would encourage it. I know it's not convenient to come to Austin. I say that all the time, but right now, this is where everything happens, and if you get a chance to come to one of those, it would be valuable. The only member right now who has a vast experience with that is Chairman DeGeer. He sat on this as the liaison from this committee to that committee for 8, 8 years almost. And I think he'll validate what I'm saying. There's a lot of work that goes on the curriculum and testing side. And you see it in the form of the rules and the skills and things like that. But those guys get in the weeds. They do a lot of work there. Not to take anything away from what this committee does. I think this committee plays a key role in making sure that the rules, which are going to apply to all certified firefighters across the state, all of those entities we regulate, your role is to make sure those rules are consistent and in the best interest of the fire service and firefighter safety. Health and wellness, again, they're going to play the same role that you're playing, an extremely important role. So the rule adoption process, any rule, anybody in the state of Texas can make a request for a change to the rule. That request has to originate with the commission. So if me as the agency chief, if I get an email from a citizen that, hey, we don't like your rule on ADA accommodations, just an example. They'll send an email to me with their complaint. I forward that. We put that on the commissioner's agenda for the next meeting. They'll hear the complaint. Hopefully we have the person there to speak to that topic. And then we'll present the rule to them so they can see it. We probably will present some language changes for them to look at. Typically, they'll take that rule and they'll kick it. Historically, they kick it back to you guys, the Firefighter Advisory Committee. If it's something to do with health and wellness, I can see them now kicking that to them. But either way, they will assign it to a committee. That rule change has to initiate with the commissioners. It'll end with the commissioners because whichever committee gets it, they'll look at it, they'll make recommendations, maybe changes to the recommendations. They'll send it back to the commissioners, and the commissioners will finally adopt it. Before any of that can happen, that rule has to go to the Texas Register. It has to be open for public comment. That's typically a 30-day public comment period. So the way that works, at that first commission meeting, they hear about it, they talk about it, they say, okay, we want to kick this to Firefighter Advisory. It comes to you guys, but at the same time, it goes out because it's being considered. There's a rule change being considered, so it goes out for public comment. There's a lot more that goes into that. We have to send that to the governor's office. They have to look at it for any conflicts of interest or competitive impediments, things of that nature. So there's a lot that goes on between that commission meeting where they hear it for the first time, it gets sent to a committee, and then it comes back to them. When it comes back to them, it typically is up for final adoption. They don't have to adopt it. They don't have to accept any of the changes. They can make additions to those changes, or they can table it for more discussion. The only thing they can't do by law, they cannot send it back to a committee or send it to another committee. After it's been sent to a committee once, it's back in the lap of the commissioners, and it's up to them to address that. Typically, a rule change here, if we follow the law, and we do, it's a six-month process, so nothing happens fast. This is government, it's bureaucracy. We love it. You're part of it now. Welcome to the machine. So, and that'll be as clear as it is for about 30 seconds, and we'll move on, and it'll become unclear again. And it's unclear to all of us. And again, that's why we have Frank, and Frank keeps us all in line with that. Again, I already mentioned this. It gets submitted to the governor's regulatory compliance office. They review it at the same time the public and you guys are reviewing it. And I've already covered all this, so I got ahead of my slides. All right, so staff, this is where that work truck comes in. There's 33 full-time employees here on staff. I guess it starts and ends with me. I'm Mike Wisco. I'm the agency chief. It's all my fault. It's okay, blame me. If you don't have my cell number, I'll give it to you. But the buck stops with me, and Frank tries to keep me out of trouble. This is Frank King. He's our legal counsel. Short history lesson. We're grateful to have Frank. From 1997 until last year, we didn't have a legal counsel. If we needed any legal opinion or when we had a meeting, we had to get somebody from the Attorney General's office assigned to us to come over and assist us. As you can imagine, in government, you get an attorney here for the first time, you have to bring them up to speed. That could take a great deal of time. Then we have a problem, we got to educate them on all the issues of the problem. So we're grateful that we were able to find the funding and be able to bring Frank on, because he spent the last year and 2 months now drinking from a fire hose, if you will. And he's all caught up. He doesn't have any questions. He understands everything that you guys do every day, and it's working great. and I'll pause here. Frank may have some things he wants to add to this or anything I've already said.
Well, I do not have the answers to everything, but feel free, if you ever have a question or anything, email is the best way to get a hold of me, and I'll try and get back to you as soon as possible. But my job is to, you know, like we just had about the emergency agenda items, just make sure we follow the rules, the statutes, Robert's Rules of Order, all that stuff, just to make sure, you know, whatever y'all decide is done correctly and it moves forward back up to the commission. So my job's here to smooth everything out and answer as many questions as I can. I don't have the answers to everything. You may ask me a question, I'll give you a typical lawyer answer. It depends. And all that means is, give me a little time, I'll do some research and get back to you. So that's my job here, and glad to be here. Love working with these guys, and like I said, let me know if I can do anything for you.
So then you look at the org chart, still at the top, but off to the left of me, it says executive assistant. We're in a little transition right now. We just hired a new executive assistant, and that is Yazzie Chavez. This is only her second meeting, and she's only been here about 3 weeks, so she's getting caught up. She's being trained by the also knowledgeable and former executive assistant, Sammy Lapista. Sammy's now our chief HR person, so she'll be the one leading the charge to fire me someday, and that's okay. But Sammy, along with her supervisor, Amanda Kahn, they keep us all in line on the paperwork side. So these are the folks that really run the place, the three of them. So next you see the Deputy Chief of Professional Development, Cliff Grant, sit back over in the corner. And Cliff is responsible for the professional development side of the house. So you see under him there is the compliance division. And Rick Wallace is here somewhere. There's Rick. And Rick and his 8 compliance officers, they wander around the state looking for problems. And they do a pretty good job. So they're responsible for all the compliance inspections. So at your departments, the commission dreadedly shows up every 2 years, and we're there to make sure everything right. That's our compliance division that handles that. We show up to investigate injuries and complaints. That falls on the compliance division to handle that. We do training facility audits. A lot of times that's the testing division, but a lot of times compliance helps out with that. When we do exam proctoring out there, we're really in favor of online exams, but when we have to print out exams and they're paper exams, 9 times out of 10, if nobody in testing is available, the compliance officer is the one that handles that. So compliance, they're like Frank. They take a beating on a daily basis, and they're making things happen out there. And I don't know if, Rick, do you want to add to any of that? Did I miss anything or misspeak?
I'm here if you guys need.
And in reality, you know, I said they're out there looking for trouble. We don't have to go looking for it. There are plenty of problems. I can tell you today while we're sitting here, there's over 40 open investigations, whether those are injuries or complaints. And our compliance team take that very serious. They work with Frank on that. We try to work through that. We try to prevent any kind of fines or loss of certification or anything like that. And in fact, since 1969, there have been 3 regulated entities assessed a monetary fine. And that's not to say we don't get to the point where that becomes a reality, where they read a piece of paper, you're about to be fined. But generally, with the help of compliance and legal, they sit down at the table and they come to some conclusion on that. And we avoid that. The next division underneath Cliff is our training and testing division. Joyce is here. Joyce is our rock star. If you've ever done anything when it comes to training or testing, everybody loves Joyce, and she keeps the wheels on the bus. Her and her staff are phenomenal. There's only 4 of them over there, and they grade tests, and they do proctor exams, and they solve problems. They do record reviews when people are trying to get reciprocity in Texas, and they make it happen. But they're kind of the behind the scenes. You see the compliance folks all the time. you don't see them. You talk to them in an email or on the phone, and they're phenomenal. They're a great asset here. We have the certification division. Is Holden over there? No? Okay, so Holden's not here, but we have a certification division. These are the folks that make sure everything's going smoothly with certification. So renewal, we do an annual renewal. They manage that renewal process for 38,000 people. When you're trying to get a higher level of certification, you're going to work with certification to make sure all the boxes are checked and that happens. Certification folks are cross-trained, and they help out a lot with the testing folks over there. They get brought into a lot of conversations with compliance sometimes on issues. So, again, it's a big machine. There's only 33 people here, but this professional development group, and I left out the most important, our information officer, which is Grace Wilson. She's hiding behind the computer there and making this PowerPoint work right now. But Grace is the one that gets the information out. One of our charges you read in the mission was information, education. And Grace is the one that makes that happen. Grace is the architect and author of the annual injury report. She puts that together every year and tries to make sense of it. She takes recommendations from every angle and tries to make that work and does a phenomenal job with that. Cliff, did I leave anything out? Anything you want to add?
No.
All right. If anything goes wrong here, it's my fault, but Cliff's going to make it right, so work with Cliff. I take smart people with me everywhere I go, and Cliff and Rick are two of them that go with me everywhere I go. So, then you follow that line down to the right and to the bottom. We have our information technology. That's our IT group. I think we have two. I know we got Robert here. Robert keeps the office running every day and makes sure everything works. Our IT, our chief information officer is Mohammed Adams, and he's fantastic. He's got a crew of five over there, and they handle the FIDO system, the farm system, which is our side of it. They make everything in this room work, and without IT, we wouldn't be where we are. The online testing, all of that. And then we have our support services. Amanda's not here this morning, but Amanda's over finance and HR. And they do a phenomenal job. They are truly behind the scenes every day, and we try to guard them and protect them from the public. But they're the ones that collect the money and make sure the bills get paid and make sure we meet our appropriation obligation every year with the legislature. And again, Sammy, she makes sure everybody behaves herself. And she's responsible for hiring new folks, and she does a great job. So that's pretty much the agency. 33 people, 8 divisions, and that's who we are. But you guys are a big piece of that, too. And so we're here to help you every step of the way through your meetings and beyond. All right, so there's two major goals for the commission. Educate, train, and get information to the fire service and to the public. Clearly, our primary stakeholders are the folks that we have the most contact with are the fire service, and I will affectionately call them our stakeholders on a regular basis. We do get public inquiries. Generally, because of the way it's set up, there's a lot of confusion. We get called about things that the State Fire Marshal's Office does, and so we make sure that gets facilitated. But we do provide information through our website, through our resource library. We're on social media. I think our primary social media is Facebook, and we get a pretty good outcome. And I should say, we're broadcasting this on Facebook today, aren't we? Yes, so your meetings and the commission meetings are broadcast. The audio part is broadcast over Facebook, so people that can't be here can at least hear what we're saying and what's going on. That's helped a lot with just educating folks about who we are, what we do, why the decisions that are made. What's missing from that is there's no way for a two-way conversation with them. While the state allows for Zoom meetings or team meetings or whatever, interactive meetings like that, we're not set up for that yet. We're working towards that, and we hope that soon this room, you see the monitors already, but we're working on getting funding to have cameras in here, and because the law says that if you televise it, they have to see who's speaking. And so we hope to get to the point someday where even you as a committee member, if you can't be here in the room that day, you can log in on some source like that, and in front of your computer, we can see you when you're talking. You can see who's in the room. There always has to be a public meeting space, and that will always be this room or wherever our headquarters is, and the presiding officer of whatever group is meeting, whether it's the commission or one of the committees, the presiding officer has to be here in Austin in that room where the public can show up and interact. But we're working towards that. We're not there yet. And it's money and technology and all that goes hand in hand, and you guys understand that. So we're working towards that. Our second major goal is enforcement of statewide fire service standards. This is where this gets really messy, but at the end of the day, it's great, and we're fortunate we're one of the few states in the United States that has an agency like the Commission on Fire Protection. So, education and training. We develop the credentials and the requirements. We have 7 mandatory certifications. What makes it mandatory is if that is the assigned duty. So we have basic firefighter, we have ARF, we have Marine, we have inspector, there's head of department. If that is your assigned discipline in your organization, there's a certification that you're required to hold to do that. At the same time, we have 17 voluntary certifications out there. Those voluntary certs are certifications that over the years folks have said it'd be nice to have this, or professional development type thing. We've just added a new one. We've added 2 new ones in the last year, a fire marshal certification, and right now we're in the first year of a rope rescue certification. There's more to come on the technical rescue side of it, but those 17 voluntary certs are not required by law, but they're available, and folks get them. I mean, that number of 38,000 certified firefighters, 37,900 of them hold more than one certification. There are folks out there that hold all 17 of our certifications. But then at the same time, you see next to certification, it says multiple disciplines. There's 46 levels. And what that means is you have a basic level, and there's usually an intermediate, an advanced, and master. That's generally across the board. So you tally all those up, it's 46. We might even be a little higher with the addition of the tech rescue stuff. This falls back on the testing and training folks and the certification folks to keep that in line. And there are rules as we work through this. In fact, one of those rules is in front of you for a rule review today. That's 423. It really starts to break down all those different levels and what it takes to get to those levels. And so that's where the minutia of bureaucracy comes into play. And we'll get into the weeds on that one in a minute because it just happens to be one we're reviewing. Most of the curriculum and a lot of our safety standards are derived from NFPA recommendations. And in the state of Texas, there are some NFPA standards that are in the state law. So what that means is that as an agency, as a professional agency of the fire service, we don't get to say, we don't get to pick and choose which NFPA standards we're going to follow. The state law, 419, says we will enforce these. And what the law says, and I know all of you are going to read it one night, it says the most current standard, most current NFPA standard in some of these areas is what is required. And to break it down, we're really talking about PPE, SCBA, pass alarms, and then you get into a few operational NFPA standards, which are accountability systems, incident operation, things like that. So that falls on, again, on compliance. They're going to make sure everybody's doing that out there. Where that ties back into you, it's in the rules. We have to make sure the rules read appropriately and they're easy to understand and follow. So when changes to these rules come up, they're requested or they're required, it's really going to be dependent upon you guys to make sure we're getting it right and recommend that back to the commissioners. And I missed one. The last one, IFSAC accreditation. So the commission is an IFSAC accredited organization. IFSAC stands for the International Fire Service Accreditation. There's 2 accrediting groups in the world. There is IFSAC, which we are a part of and accredited through. There's also Pro Board. Pro Board and IFSAC are like cousins, all right? We all just got through Thanksgiving. We're coming up on Christmas. So one time a year, all the family comes together, whether you like one another or not. By the time you're full, it's time for folks to leave. Pro Board and IFSAC really don't agree with one another. They say the exact same thing. You pick which side of the family you're going to be in, and that's what you go with. So in Texas, it's a little complicated because the state training provider, we're the regulators, we're the certifiers, but the state training provider is TEKS, a piece of Texas A&M. TEKS is a Pro Board accredited organization. So in Texas, it gets complicated because we're IFSAC. IFSAC does not like Pro Board. Pro Board does not like IFSAC. So in most places, Pro Board is not going to recognize IFSAC, nor is IFSAC going to recognize Pro Board. But in Texas, we've bent the rules a little bit. And so we have a rule and an agreement that you can go to a TEKS Pro Board class and get that training, and you tell them at the very beginning you're taking this class because you want a TCFB certification for whatever that might be. You can do that. But at the end of that Pro Board class, you're going to have to do TCFP skills and take a TCFP exam to get that certification. What you will not get at the end of that is that IFSAC seal, because you took it based on Pro Board standards. So we maintain the hate relationship there, but we allow for the training you're getting right here in Texas through the training provider that's in Texas, we allow that training to count towards certification with the commission. Very complicated. That's the best I can explain it, and you'll ask questions down the road, and it'll take an hour for us to work through it. We have a great relationship with TEKS. This arrangement's been in place since 2003 or 4. It's been here a while now.
About 20 years.
And it's all based on an MOU. But it works, and it gets very confusing on a daily basis, and we make it work. So Texas does not recognize Pro Board because we're IFSAC. But if you take a Pro Board class at TEKS, you can get a certification with us without the IFSAC. So that's as easy as that gets. And we'll move on because I'm confused already. So we share information through the website, social media. We have a resource library. We're currently rebuilding that library. It was gravely out of date. And when we made the move from our last office to here, we realized just how out of date it was. And so we're building up our resources again. What's available today in that resource library is any reference material that is used for the curriculum for the certifications we have. And it's available. You can go online. You can check out a book like you would at the library. Hell, you can sit down up here in a little room with the books around you if you want, if it makes you feel good. So we have that, and we're working to build that. We do our injury reporting. I've talked about that a little bit. Grace is the author of that and the mastermind behind it. That injury report is required reading on an annual basis. The commissioners passed a rule a couple of years ago that everybody has to do 2 hours of CE annually on that injury report. That's important because everybody needs to understand how we're getting hurt. I'll tell you, we haven't found any new ways to get hurt as firefighters. We do it the same old way. We just do it in a different department every day. So the educational value of understanding how that happened and maybe thinking through how we could prevent it in your own departments probably works, and it all comes from 2 hours of training. So you print it out, you put it on the kitchen table, you put it in whatever room of the fire station you want, the guys read it, they document they did it, you got 2 hours of training. What we have seen are some pretty remarkable things. We're seeing injuries on the decrease. We're actually seeing the numbers go down. We're generally, for the first 14 years we did this, we were in the 6,000 to 7,000 range. This year we came in between 4,000 and 5,000. That's progress. We're not getting hurt as often, maybe. EMS injuries are a big deal. When I first got in this role 4.5 years ago, our burn injuries were continuing to decline. And we got to a point in 2021 that we saw 9% of the recorded injuries annually occur on the fire ground. We saw 37% of the recorded injuries annually occur in the fire station. So if you ever had to sit through an agonizing presentation by me, you would hear me say it's safer to be at a fire in Texas than it is to be at the fire station. That is what it is. We've all worked in it, so you understand what I'm saying there. We saw an alarming increase in the 23 injury reporting numbers. We've seen an increase of 20%, almost over 20%, in burn injuries that are occurring out there. It falls on compliance. So earlier I talked about they have 40 open investigations right now. A lot of those are burn injuries. We're not going in to place blame, we're going in to understand how this injury occurred and what can be done to prevent that. Was it a failure of the PPE? If it was, we have great relationships with the manufacturers out there. We take that back to them and we share with them what happened. And hopefully it helps them manufacture a better product. Was it a scenario where maybe the wearer, the firefighter of that PPE, pushed that protective clothing beyond the limits it's designed for? That becomes an educational issue. Either way, we don't go in to investigate these injuries to place blame. We're going to figure out how it happened because the goal is to prevent it from happening. And so that's a big part of the injury reporting. What has to be reported to us is anything that's reported to workers' comp. Leads to the question. This question hasn't gone away in 15 years now of doing this. Why can't the Commission on Fire Protection just lean on the Department of Insurance to get that information? Why does a fire department have to report their injuries? TDI, or the Workers' Comp Division, they don't gather it and separate it by profession. So they see 40,000 injuries a year, worker comp claims. They can't tell you how many of those were firefighters or police officers or EMS workers. So the legislature said, you guys are going to figure that out. So we have a rule. You'll see it. It's in 435. All injuries that are reportable workers' comp have to be reported to us. That has fragmented and grown over the years out of necessity, out of importance. We're gathering data now on cancer-related injuries, cancer-related deaths. We're trying to gather information on suicides and mental health issues. None of that is defined in the law, but it's important to our profession to understand and to get our arms around, and that drives this injury report every year becoming bigger and bigger as far as information that's in it, which led to, hey, I think everybody needs to read this, and that's how we got there. The last piece, the stakeholder meetings. We go around the state. The agency staff goes around the state, usually 13, 14 meetings a year, where we go out into the state of Texas and we meet with the stakeholders, the fire chiefs, the training facilities, whoever wants to come to this meeting. We talk about what's going on. We listen to their concerns. We have had a lot of ideas come from those regional meetings that we've been able to come back and help foster some change in a rule or in some of our internal processes to try to make it better. I'll go so far as to say in 2019, 2020, this was the most hated part of the Texas Fire Service, was this agency right here, only because nobody likes to be regulated. But some would say maybe we weren't keeping up with the time. Some were saying we were being unreasonable or unrational. I think over the last 4 years, we've taken a hard look as an agency. We've opened our ears. We've looked at our processes. We've heard ideas on how to make the processes better. The committees have made suggestions. The commissioners have made suggestions. I think today, this agency is regarded a little bit different in that we truly are a partner in trying to keep everybody safe. We want them to be educated. We want them to have the tools they need to do their job. We want them to be able to function safely. And all of that is driven by our rules and our internal processes and the decisions that the commissioners make. And so you guys really have a big role in that and where we're going with this. More on compliance. They do the inspections. They inspect fire departments, ESDs, standalone fire marshal offices, training facilities, other municipal organizations. There are fire departments who they contract with a MUD, a municipal utility district, but they get money. So that MUD is a government entity. If they're providing money to this fire department, that makes them theoretically a regulated entity. And we fight these battles on a daily basis. All of it has nothing to do with, hey, we got the authority to come in and be big brother. It's all about keeping the firefighters safe and making sure they're provided the training and the equipment they need. That's what we do. There are standalone law enforcement offices out there that just do fire investigation. We regulate those investigators. So we do regulate some law enforcement agencies out there. And they love to be regulated by fire guys. That's fun. Some of the key compliance things that I look for, we look at personnel training records. Obviously, we look at PPE. We look at their policies and procedures, in particular the ones that are required in the state law. And again, the training records. There's a state law that each department has to retain training records for 3 years. We come in to make sure that's being done. quickest way to do that, we walk in and you've got seven hazmat techs. Hazmat has a special CE requirement. So we might randomly select three guys on the list that are in your department who are hazmat techs. We want to see you their CE. And we can go back as far as 3 years. Again, all of that is in keeping with the law and making sure that everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. We covered this, certification, 7 mandatory, 17 voluntary. There's CE requirements for each. Then you get into some of the mandated NFPA standards. Yeah, I'm getting close to the end of this. PPE, the selection, the care, the maintenance. So that's NFPA 1971, NFPA 1851, SCBA, so that's 1981. All of that is extremely important. It's state law. It's not something that the commissioners or the staff or you as committee members say, we want to enforce this and we don't want to enforce that. It's adopted by the Texas legislature. Everything in those particular standards is state law. And it's our job to enforce it. There's a lot going on with this right now. NFPA is retooling. They're starting to combine standards. The first one just occurred. NFPA 1970 has taken everything to do with PPE and SCBAs and putting it in one standard. So you're going to hear a lot about this over the next year. Your next three or four meetings are going to have a lot going on about 1970 because we've got to update our rules. We've got to change the way we're doing that because not everything in that standard is covered by our state law, but most of it is. So we've got to be able to disseminate that. So there'll be a lot in the coming months, in the coming meetings with 435 and dealing with 1970. Hot on the heels of 1970 will be the new 1850. It's going to incorporate all of 1851, a lot of 1852, and that has to do with how we clean and maintain the equipment. We'll go through the same process. We already started, and they'll be going a parallel course on the educational side of it. They're merging all their educational standards. So the training standards for firefighter, or driver operator, or company officer, things like that are all being and consolidated into standalone standards. So we're having to work this on both sides. NFPA says it's a 10-year process. I hope we're done in 15 years updating it, but I don't think we'll ever be done. I think we might catch up, and then there'll be more changes going on. So a lot of that work is going to fall on those three committees. You guys are one of those. And a lot of what you're going to be doing is in the weeds of these NFPA standards and our rules and how we tie it together. So a lot of reading assignments. A lot of homework. The other NFPA mandates are, again, incident management, personnel accountability, incident operations. And we get into the training records. I've touched on all of that already. FIDO, everybody's familiar with the FIDO system. You can go in, you manage your certifications, you pay your certification renewal fees or your certification upgrades, and it's just an opportunity to have all that information in one place. This is a home-built system. The legislature never gave this agency money to build it. They just gave them the mandate to build it. Factually, it started off being built in somebody's garage. One of the members of the commission staff back in the 2013 to 2016 range was a computer guy, and he was working on this at night when he was off and building this system. Our IT folks that I talked about earlier, they're holding it together every single day. And it's my job as the administrator of the group to go to the legislature and try to get more funding so we can improve our technology. And without our IT folks holding it together with duct tape and bungee cords and whatever else they find, sometimes that's how it works. Painfully, every year during renewal, we try to renew 38,000 people in a 60-day period. And on any one particular day, the Houston Fire Department with almost 4,000 members and the Dallas Fire Department with over 2,000 members all hit renew at the same moment, it could crash the system. It does crash the system. That affects everybody else because now they're trying to renew and they can't do that. So they email or call, your system is crap. Yeah, we know, we're working on it. Those IT guys, those certification folks, those testing people, they're working behind the scenes to get it back online. And that's a busy 60 days for staff around here, but it works. We have once again survived another renewal period. Let's talk about money for a minute, and then we'll be done with this. So right now, in the 24-25 biennial appropriations period, the legislature has given us $7.6 million to operate this agency. At the same time, we have a mandate from the legislature that we have to generate revenue that exceeds our appropriations. So in other words, we have to bring in money for the state of Texas that equals the 7.6 they've given us to function. In addition, we have to generate an extra $1.5 million on top of that. That's called a rider. All of that money, $9.1 million that we are obligated to bring into the state of Texas, goes back to the state of Texas. It does not come to this agency. So if you've ever thought that those guys are just up there collecting this money so they can drive big cars or have fancy offices, couldn't be farther from the truth. We don't see a penny of that. It all goes back to the state of Texas. And every 2 years, we go beg to get that money back. And graciously enough, last session, they gave us 2.6. We're going to go back and ask for another 1.6 this time, and I hope to get that back. In reality, we're bringing in over $10 million in that two-year period, and I'm proud of that. That means that we have a lot of people who want the certifications we offer, and they play by the rules. We have training facilities and fire departments that are paying the fees they're supposed to pay, and it works out. I talked about IFSAC earlier. There's an IFSAC fee. You want that IFSAC seal on your certificate? It's going to cost you $30 to get that seal. The money that we collect from selling those IFSAC seals for your certificates stays at the agency. So we do, in fact, keep the IFSAC funds here, and we're able to use that for chairs or IT equipment or whatever we might need around here to keep this place up and running, new computers, whatever it is. It's a small amount of money. It's less than $240,000 in this period. It helps us kind of do some things that we haven't been able to do before. And so once it gets the firefighter, they get an IFSAC seal, and they can leave Texas and take that certification with them to any other state that recognizes IFSAC. What it does for us, it creates a lot of heartburn, but it gets us a little bit of money, so we got some spending money over here that we can keep this place up and running if the legislature didn't give us enough to do that. And all that means is I didn't do my job in asking for that money. So that is really it. These are the ways you can learn about us and read about us and contact us. And that was a lot, but any questions? I'll try to answer them. I know you got something. I don't know if you want to ask them or not.
I do have a question.
Come on.
The $1.5 million rider.
Yep.
Is that, excuse my ignorance, is that common practice for regulatory agencies?
It is for this regulatory agency. That's the safest answer I'll give you. It happened years ago at a time that some people were unhappy with the way this agency was functioning. So maybe there were some that saw that was a way to force this agency out of business. It didn't work. It's working. Because I think the fire service wants the standards. The fire service wants the regulation to an extent. We want to make sure everybody's safe. And so it's worked, and we continue to add voluntary certifications and things like that. I will tell you that it drove that decision, that rider drove this agency to raise the fees, the certification fees, to an unheard of level. In 2011, they took the fees from $35 for certification to $85. That has been a point of contention since 2011. Today, the commissioners have worked. We've gotten those fees down. Your certification renewal fee now is $60 a year. While you pay a fee for every new certification you get, when you renew every October, you pay $60, and that renews all your certifications. So if Mike Wisco has all 17 commission certifications out there, me or my department paid for me to get that initial certification, $85 a pop. But every year, that cert gets renewed with $160 fee. That fee was $85 at one time, and over the years, through the positive work of a lot of people, and we saw where we were meeting that obligation, actually exceeding it like we are today, we were able to lower those fees comfortably enough to try to get back to reality. I can tell you at some point, we're going to be asked to lower those fees again. That's going to be a huge exercise where we really have to look at that. What can we afford to lower it to and still be able to meet that obligation? The only way that rider ever goes away is for somebody, our stakeholders, not us, not a state agency. We're not allowed to lobby. But if our stakeholders go to the legislature and say, we don't think this is fair, we don't think it's right, and if they'll buy into that, they could theoretically do away with it. There's been a lot of effort since 2011 to do that, and they haven't been successful. They did get it lowered. It started as a $3 million rider, so $3 million above the general appropriation number. And through a lot of work, the State Association, Texas Fire Chiefs, other groups like that, in 2017, it got lowered. I'm sorry, 2015, it got lowered by $1.5 million. So it's down to $1.5 million now. But I don't think it's normal. There are some other state agencies out there that are starting to see that same model. But it's been here since 2011, so it's a we just live with it, and it's working. I really can't dispute that. The numbers prove that it's working. So I hope I answered your question.
Yes, sir. Are there any points where the three committees and the commissioners gather together?
You know, that hasn't happened in a long time. I can remember it happened back in the 90s, and I think we did it once in the early 2000s, but it hasn't happened recently. It's not to say it couldn't happen. Now, at every commission meeting, they meet quarterly, and we'll talk about their meeting schedule later in this meeting. But at those commission meetings, they get a report from each committee. The committee chair provides a report for what's going on. You as committee members are certainly welcome to be there. I do see moving forward, and this has happened before, but I see it happening more as we work through these NFPA changes. I see joint subcommittees of these three committees, members from those three committees working together on certain things. So I think as we move forward, I think you'll see more and more of that, at least at a subcommittee level. Actually, a meeting of everybody there, I don't know that we could do that, but we'd certainly try if somebody ever wanted to do that. This room would be full of tables and chairs and microphones. But no, but it does happen to some extent at various levels. And I think it'll happen a lot more as we work through some of the changes that we're going through.
Thank you.
Yeah, Daniel, you might want to speak to some. I know there's been some with curriculum and testing in this committee. Yeah.
Well, and we just got done revamping and restaffing all of the committees. So for the last 2 years, we've been in flux with a lot of people just holding positions until the appointments could take place. So I think starting in 2025, I see everybody being past that bump in the road, if we would, and moving into the next phase of moving forward. So there's been a lot of talk from all three committees about doing that. So we're not operating in separate silos, but there's some, you know, clear communication. But we do all get together at the commission meetings.
Right.
So everybody is in the same room, and all committees are represented at the same time. So the commissioners can address or ask any questions they want to. But we've talked about maybe, and I don't know if that's even allowable, but at twice a year, the commissioners have a workshop as well as their meeting. And we would, I know, having talked to Pat McAuliffe, who's the chair of the curriculum and testing, and Chief Doug Boker, who's the chair of the health and wellness, about possibly having all those committees represented in those workshops, just so that any questions can be vetted out at that time and we can move forward. So I see that happening in the near future.
And these committees, just like the commission meetings, are public meetings, so anybody's welcome to them. The only meeting that takes place that's closed to the public is if the commissioners go into executive session. They can only go into executive session for legal matters or personnel matters specific to the agency chief. And so those executive sessions are far and few. Hopefully they're far and few in the future, and they're brief. But there are opportunities, and they just dismiss everybody from the room for a few minutes while they talk, and they come back. No action's ever taken. Any action that comes from that discussion has to happen in an open meeting. So I'll add this, and I'll shut up. This committee, as you guys sit here, Firefighter Advisory Committee, has been in existence since 1991 as we currently function as an agency. The curriculum and testing, the same thing. There have been a lot of people that have sat in the chairs where you sat and have gotten us to where we are today. And I say that because this committee, curriculum and testing, because they're the two longest standing committees, they're the backbone of this agency. Yeah, we got 33 staff people. We make it work. We take whatever the rules say, and we make that happen. And we've got great people on staff, and they do a great job every day. But what comes out of these committees is recommendations to the commissioners and the rules the commissioners make. That's what drives this place, and that's what keeps this agency running. And so when you think about that for a second, we're a state regulatory agency, but we are managed and guided by the people we're regulating. The members of the fire service sit on these three committees. The members of the fire service sit on the commission, and you're controlling your own destiny to a large extent. Yeah, we get our authority from the legislature, we get our money from the legislature, but the fire service controls this regulatory agency. And I think that's something to be proud of. And you look at what we've got. Most states in the United States don't have this to this level. And so there's a lot of history here. There's a lot of good that's happened here. There's a lot of people around the country that look at what we're doing in Texas. And I think we do a great job. I don't mind saying that. And I think this committee, as it stands, does a lot of the work here for that. So we appreciate your time and your willingness to be part of this, and we're grateful to have you here.
If you don't mind me piggybacking on that, we're also blessed that our agency chief had served on this committee for more than 20 years as well. And we're going to talk about a couple rules here in a few minutes, and questions will come up looking for the historical background of how we got there, how these decisions were made. And it's beneficial that our agency chief sometimes sat in those meetings decades ago, and then also to recognize, I know Jim Rainey's in the room, and he served on this committee for more than 20 years and was the chair of this committee for years and years and years, and he's a wealth of knowledge as well. Jim, I hope you just want to recognize you here for a second, but I hope you still come to the meetings, because between these two gentlemen here, they understand how we got here. Some of these things may not make sense today, but they may have been a contentious argument in a room full of people that were arguing 10, 20, 30 years ago, especially going back to 1991. So we'll have to defer to those folks many times to ask for their opinions, to understand why something says what it does on the piece of paper. It may not be relevant anymore in 2024, but we at least would understand how we got here. So that's a benefit that we have as a committee. So thank you to both of you for having served on this committee for years. Also, many of the commissioners that you've seen over the years had served on this committee as well, including the current presiding officer.
Yeah.
He has served on this committee for a number of years.
And Buford.
Yeah, and Daniel Buford came from this committee as well. So, all right, anything else, Chief?
That's it under this. Unless I missed anything. Frank, do we miss anything from the fiscal standpoint?
All right, if you don't mind, I have 11:03. I'm going to call a quick timeout. We'll come back at 11:10, take a quick bathroom break. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, turn off your mic. Turn off your mic. You guys ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we will resume our meeting.
Make sure you turn your microphones back on.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. He's got the mics back on. All right, item number three, adoption of the September 26, 2024 Firefighter Advisory Committee meeting minutes.
Okay, there's really only three of us here that were at that meeting to know whether or not those minutes are accurate. So hopefully you've all had a chance to read through it. Did you guys see anything that looked inaccurate? I didn't see anything that raised a concern to me at all. Okay, I'll entertain a motion.
Make a motion to approve the minutes.
Okay. Daniel Anderson has a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll second.
Who's that? Okay. We got a second?
From Shane Parker.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry. All right. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. So the minutes have been approved. Moving forward.
Before you leave.
Okay.
Move on. Number four?
Yeah.
All right. Item number four, discussion and possible action on the rule review of 37 Texas Administrative Code, Chapter 423, Fire Suppression.
Okay.
Many members, this is sent to you from the commissioners. This is a required rule review. So every 4 years we have to review all the rules. And so this was put on the commissioner's plate at their November meeting. They've assigned it to you guys to take a look at it, make any suggestions, corrections, changes, whatever you want, make those recommendations. We'll capture that in a document and get it back to the commissioners at their February meeting.
All right, so I'm hoping you all have had an opportunity to read through this and comment or note anything that is a point of concern. Or hopefully you've talked to some other folks that may have had a view of this or passion, because it's been posted for a little while. I guess I, right off the bat, I do have a question for clarification, as long as we've been doing a class here on history. On that first page, on page, mine's showing page number 8, under 423.1, where it refers to the medical, emergency medical training, it refers to the commission recognizes the following. And my understanding is this has obviously been determined by the commissioners to be the accepted list, but my question is, who vets this out to make sure that this stays current? And where I'm going, this may be a question for staff. Doing a little bit of research, number under AC, an American Safety and Health Institute First Responder Course, as well as B, which is the American Red Cross Emergency Response Course, I'm not able to find where either of those organizations still offer an emergency response course or a first responder course. And let's say, hypothetically, one of those programs no longer exists because that agency went out of business or just deleted that program. Is this the opportunity now where we do the homework?
This is why we do the rule reviews, yeah.
Right. So I don't know if anybody else, if that was glaring for you, especially because the job of a firefighter compared to 1991 is clearly EMS in today's world.
Yeah, the only thing that I found under the National Safety Council was the EMR. But the National Safety Council, I don't know if it embedded within one of those that they're referring to, but I didn't see anything. I'm like you. I looked at those two organizations, and I didn't see anything that pertains to anything that would be a validated level of training for a firefighter here. So I also
was looking at this. And again, under C, the American Safety and Health Institute First Responder, the main things that come up, I saw some ASHI courses, and anything under First Responder was kind of confined to CPR training alone. And so if I'm looking at that like somebody may be interested in becoming a firefighter and I got to do these things, well, if all I need is a CPR course, this is beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I was able to find what they refer to as an emergency medical responder.
EMR, yes, sir.
And so I think the nomenclature is potentially outdated here. And I also made a note, just to make sure I'm understanding this right, on A, DSHA's Emergency Medical Service Personnel Certification Training, I'm reading that as I don't have to be certified, I just have to provide proof that I successfully completed any level of course.
You're right. You don't have to be certified. You don't even have to go to EMT school. We as a state agency can't tie a certification to another state certification.
Sure.
So all this rule outlines is that you have to have medical training, and these are all your options. Now, if some of these options don't exist anymore, yes, this is the time that would need to be recommended to clean that up. But nowhere in here does it say or will it ever be able to say you have to be an EMT. That is a local decision. So that's why some of these are extremely broad. I mean, you just referenced Department of State Health Services Emergency Medical Certification Personnel Certification Training. You could be an EMT, you could be a first responder, you could be a paramedic, licensed paramedic, doesn't matter. We don't care. We want to document that somewhere along the way, you've got 40 hours of medical training. That's all you have to be a certified firefighter. If your employing entity wants you to be something other than that, that's between you and them.
So there's my question. So who mandates or who comes up with the 40-hour requirement? Is that a law?
It's a rule. It's a commission
amongst
rule.
Us. So yeah. We could change that, right? Yeah. We can recommend to the commission that they change that. Because mm-hmm. there's a part of me that, I don't know about you all, but and this is just a personal opinion, I think an emergency medical training or its equivalent is the way that this should read. Because anything, to your point, the program that ASHI or whatever that agency was, I think if you were a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout, you'd have more training than the program they provide. So that's not the same thing as an emergency medical technician. We all know what that means, and that's a pretty significant amount of training. And that way exceeds the 40 hours as well. I mean, we're old enough to remember the ECA program that the Texas Department of Health used to to provide years ago, and that was your 40-hour basic first aid class, but it's not 1979 anymore, and we've raised the bar where now EMT is pretty much your basic medical training mm-hmm. in today's world. Cliff, I think you got some clarification for us or direction for us?
Mr. Chairman, Firefighter Advisor, that the medical training rule comes in from IFSAC. IFSAC requires you to have the hours of training medical-wise to include the enrichment portion. I think the 40-hour thing came in because when they were looking at this, the American Red Cross's training that is in the rule, even though it doesn't say ARC on it, that course that they used to give, well, they still give it, but you can't find it in the state of Texas, is a 40-hour course that includes the enrichment portions. And the enrichment portion is spinal immobilization, treatment for shock, and stuff like that. Now, there is another one in there that we take, which is the EMR portion of the Green Cross training. But that hourly requirement was tied into, instead of getting specific, stating a vendor that does it, was the 40-hour rule because American Red Cross's courses was 40 hours.
And so I'll piggyback to that. He's right that it's an IFSAC requirement. This rule existed before IFSAC, yeah. And the 40 hours was there before IFSAC.
Yeah.
What happened was the rule used to say medical training or its equivalent. When we got to the point of IFSAC coming into the game, which was in 1997, it was decided we needed to spell out all the options because there were so many options at the time. So, yeah. So to Cliff's point, all these options are tied back to IFSAC, but the original rule said you're going to have 40 hours of medical training. We don't care what it is. And then it got manipulated. So this has been here a long time. There might be some programs that are out of date. You might want to recommend different language, and we can have this conversation at the commission level. So.
Do you have a lot of folks who use these training programs to meet the medical requirement?
Yeah, a lot of kids, like from Canada. Now, Canada is a whole different, because the way their medical training is set up is completely different than ours. But a lot of these kids coming in nowadays, we actually have academies now or certified training facilities that incorporate the Green Cross EMR training into their academy, so the kids get the EMR training while they're there, which allows them, after they pass the course, to become state certified. And like Chief Wisco said, we don't tie it to people having to hold a basic or ours is it's ECA or EMR and above. EMR, ECA, EMT, paramedic. It's the departments are putting those demands on the level of medical training that you have. The only level or the only stipulation we put to hold active certification is you just have to have that medical training. It's the departments that put the demand on the B and above. So
if your minimum is requirement is EMR, it doesn't matter where that EMR comes from, as long as they have a minimum of 40 hours, which constitutes
the EMR. Not the minimum. 40 hours is the minimum.
Right.
40
hours. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so it can come from Green Cross, it can come from National Registry, right. It can come from DSHS. And I know National Registry, we've started to see a lot of kids, and I didn't know that they did this, but National Registry also teaches an EMR course now. There's an EMR course for National Registry.
Yeah,
and I think that's taking the place of the ECA.
It may be tied into the ECA, but I didn't even know National Registry went that low on.
To get your ECA in the state of Texas, you have to go through an approved NA.
Yeah.
NREMT EMR course.
It's because states are now a national registry state. So it used to not be. So.
Which exceeds 60 hours.
Yeah.
And excuse my ignorance, but Green Cross, we're talking about essentially medical education for a non-professional kind of maybe a citizen response?
Correct. The Green Cross or the American Institute of, I can't remember the whole name of it, but their course is designed around the ECA curriculum per se, because they do teach the enrichment portions in the EMR, C-spine immobilization, oxygen administration, and stuff like that. So you just don't have to go do the the state or national registry certification thing for it. You take their exam, and then you're EMR certified through.
Sure.
So
in 1997, when IFSAC became involved, the term paramedic engine company or truck company didn't exist in the fire service.
Sure it did, in the West Coast, California,
not Arizona. The Texas fire service.
Probably not. And you were still riding a horse, weren't you?
Perhaps. And now I look around the state of Texas, and I see so many fire departments that minimum hiring requirements are that you're a certified firefighter and a certified EMT. Yeah. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of fire departments in Texas that won't hire you unless you're already a certified paramedic in the state of Texas and a certified firefighter.
Yeah, because as well as you know, it's easier for them to send a paramedic to fire school than it is for them to send a firefighter to paramedic school.
Well, that's just for your retention efforts, so you're not having to lose an employee at the end of the day. Dallas knows all too well how that plays out. So I guess it concerns me that the bar is so low on the medical in today's world, where now many of our communities, many of the people in this room right now are used to calling 911 and having a paramedic engine company show up, mm-hmm. and that becomes your level of standard of care, yet we're still creating a system where you can go to a Green Cross program or gotten a first aid merit badge in Boy Scouts, and that helps you be a firefighter on a fire truck. I don't think that's the same quality of...
No, but the biggest majority of the kids that do that will be like your... And I'm not downgrading or anything like that, is a lot of the kids come from SFFMA to get their TCFP certification. They'll use the EMR. But like I said, it's just to get your state certification to be an active state certified firefighter. Now, when you get hired in a department, I could probably say the biggest majority of the kids that get state certified this way with that minimum medical training, and they get hired full-time at a department, whether it's an ESD, even some of the volunteer fire departments are going to be paid. As soon as they get hired, they're sending them straight to EMT basic school and above. So it's not like they're being allowed to... I shouldn't say being allowed. I don't know what the policies are. But a lot of departments won't even let them do medical stuff until they're EMT or above.
Right. So that we know in the fire service, yeah. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, that's the minimum standard of care in the yeah. fire service, at least the Texas fire service that yes. I'm familiar with. I'd like to hear what Jim has to say, because Jim's standing right behind you with a comment.
You don't have to go. Hi, Commissioners, members. Congratulations to everybody. Jim Reedy for the Texas State Association of Firefighters. So when we did this, WSCO will remember this. This was the subject of great discussion at more than one meeting. Some of the smaller departments were concerned that having that minimum be EMT basic or above that was not going to be cost them. It would be outside their ability to do. So that's why that standard was so low. ECA was really what it was set at. Raising it to EMT basic, as a citizen, I would love that. But I don't think that's practical. I really don't. You have to consider that some of these smaller departments and even some of the ESDs don't financially have that ability to do that, and they won't be able to get people to come on the job if the prerequisite is EMT basic. They won't be able to send them to EMT basic. So some upgrading of the old language that doesn't work anymore, that doesn't exist, I think would be appropriate. But going to that next level, again, as a citizen, I think that would be great. But as a representative of the state association, I don't think that's practical for all the departments. So
here's my question. So I know in 1980, as an example, almost everybody that came into the fire service came in with no education in anything, and the organization invested in them and sent them to fire school and taught them how to be a firefighter.
Or taught their own, yeah.
Yeah, but in today's world, we're pretty much putting that off onto the individual now, where departments are saying, yeah, we'll hire you, but you already have to have gone through the program yourself. That's why we see more people in the colleges and the private mm-hmm. programs to get certified as a firefighter in the state of Texas. That didn't exist. We all know that didn't exist 30 years ago.
But that's a decision of the municipality and not necessarily of the individual.
Right. So as a fire service now, we're saying your education's on you. Once you get that education, come to us. We'll look at hiring you. So if we're telling them you have to go get firefighter certified, we didn't lower the bar on that. That's the certification. Why are we lowering the bar on the EMS side of it
when that's the primary thing that we do. And why wouldn't we raise that bar?
That's a local decision, and you cannot, this state agency can't tie our certification to another state agency. EMS is regulated by the Department of Health.
Yes.
What you're essentially wanting to say is, you go see them first. If you can pass all their stuff, we'll let you try to be a firefighter. We cannot do that. No. Legally, we can't do that.
This is the Commission on Fire Protection, and while that extra added medical training is good and at a minimum, but really we regulate what we do.
We are stipulating EMS training.
We're stipulating a very minimum of first aid training, basically.
So this is, we'll stay with that subject. Somebody picked 40 hours. I'm calling that's no longer relevant in 2024. Why did we pick 20? Why did we pick 40 hours?
As somebody else said, I believe at the time that was the standard of those ECA and those programs at the time.
ECA was a 40-hour program.
The minimum was 40 hours, yeah.
Right. So basic. So it was able to stand.
First aid was a 40-hour program. That's how we got there.
So minimum hours in the state of Texas now for ECA or EMR is 60 hours.
We don't have anything to do with that.
Sure.
Don't care. We can't. We can't care.
But the language that we're using is that they must have medical training, EMR at the minimum, right?
No. Medical training.
Medical training.
Equivalent medical training.
So how do we determine what equivalent medical training
is? We can't. That's why this is so broad.
But it does say the commission recognizes the following emergency medical training.
We listed all this out because we had to list out anything that they could have shown up here with that met IFSAC and the training requirement. So we could add six more pages of this if you guys would like. But the point is, we can't tell them what they have to go get. They just have to have some kind of basic first aid, period. I can remember, in 1995, the rule said you had to have the American Red Cross basic first aid class, period. That's what it said. Then it graduated to, well, we'll take Red Cross, or we'll take your state EMT or paramedic or whatever. And then we got IFSAC in 97, and we got to where we're at right now.
So I think it'd be worth our time to vet. We know the NREMT exists. We know DISHES exist. But what we're not certain of is the names or the titles of these courses through ASHI and the American Red Cross. I think it'd be worth our time to vet. Is that the accurate nomenclature as a reference that's in the code? Would that be worth our time?
It's all worth the time. You could recommend it to the commission. We'll see what they do with it. I mean,
I think if we're going to put that much work into it, would it make more sense to come up with an hours or topic-based assessment so we're not in the same situation in 5 years when those courses are changed or no longer the same? Just finding out what that minimum standard is of 40 hours in this or 60 hours total so it's not tied to a specific course or provider?
I don't know. I mean, so we're reviewing this rule for this very reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the commissioners, you know, you showed a few minutes ago, there's a handful of them that are not even in the fire service, but mm-hmm. they're serving the fire service in the state of Texas. So our efforts are to advise and make that suggestion or recommendation to them. I'm not comfortable sending this to them saying we're going to give a big check mark on 423 and say it's good to go, and we're all sitting here with some kind of concern that the medical world has changed since this was written last.
Yes, so as part of the rule review, that's the job, is to make sure it's still valid.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not valid, then your job is to make it valid or delete it. If it's not around anymore, it shouldn't be in the rule.
Well, and to clarify, our job is to recommend that. It was the commissioners that would either take it or not.
Right, but your job is to do the research and verify that this still, you know, if they're still around or that class is still available. If it's not, then you tell the commissioners it's not available anymore.
You know? Frank, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's nothing that says you guys couldn't say, we want to keep working on this. Mm-hmm. We want to do some research. We want to have this on our next agenda. And in February, when you give your committee report to them, you guys sent us 423. we're kind of hung up on a couple of things, and we're going to take some more time to vet this out. There's no real timeline on a rule review. It just has to be done. I'm right in what I'm saying. You don't have to send them something back to their February meeting other than, hey, we're still looking at this. We got some questions about this and that and the other. We're going to bring it back to you, but we're not done with this yet.
Well, so I understand we can have a motion to table this.
That's correct.
For the review. Before we would do that, though, I'd like to ask that we talk about the rest of this, because there may be other aspects of this that we want to come back and review.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah. How's your chance?
I don't think we have the answers here today.
No, but you're well within your right to do exactly what you want to do, and there's nothing that says you have to make a decision today, other than maybe that decision is, hey, we want to table this to our next meeting. And between now and then, everybody do a little research on it. And staff can help with some of that. We can research from the IFSEC side out there. But it got sent to you guys for a review, and I think that's what you're trying to do, and I think that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
There's no time frame on this.
I do have a question, Chief. On letter E for medical training deemed funded by the commission, what kind of training, medical training, is being submitted to the commission, besides the EMT, obviously, and paramedic, but what kind of lower level is being submitted?
Well, I think that goes back to what Chris was just saying. I mean, it depends.
Mark,
depends on where they come from.
It depends.
If they're coming out of Canada, and they're coming to get the IFSEC seal, but they have to get our certification to get that, they're bringing us whatever the medical training standard is in Canada. So it's wide open. It is wide open.
So, but it says medical training deemed equivalent.
Yes.
So that means equivalent to a standard that we're accepting. That's where my question lies. I think our bar, our standard, is not in the right place.
Well, I don't think our bar, our standard, is no longer clear, because it started as basic first aid from American Red Cross. I don't think that ever changed, but I don't think that's anywhere in any of the rules. That bar is not identified other than just in practice and from the IFSEC side, their bar. And their bar is
so
40 hours, I think.
So leaving Canada out of this, if Vince goes and he takes a class every week, and it's basic first aid with my volunteer fire department as an example, and I'm going through SFMA, and now I'm going to apply for my certification, I show the fire commission that I have, 100 hours of weekly training of first aid, and I give you the training records of that, does that make me certifiable, because that medical is equivalent to what the fire commission would deem as equivalent training?
No, because it's not taught by a certifying agency. It's not taught by National Registry. It's not taught by DSHS. It's not taught by American Red Cross. It's not taught by the American Standard Health Institute or anything like that. Just because it says that you've done first aid training on a training record, that doesn't suffice. Or anything like that.
So it's got to be a recognized agency.
It's got to be a recognized agency. And I will tell you, we're starting to see more and more, just as you guys understand, that this past decade, we've had many wars and stuff like that. So we got people coming out of the military that are more highly trained than most paramedics on the street. If they have TCCC, and they have the full course, they can actually do cut downs in chest tubes. And here we are telling these people that they can't do it because they didn't receive the training 40 hours or anything like that. So that's one thing you have to look at, because if you look at TCCC's curriculum, it's amazing.
So would this be an opportunity to add that to the list? So
yes, we do take TCCC. We do take that, because that falls under the medical training that is equivalent, because that goes above and beyond a lot of the stuff that we have.
But it doesn't say it in here right now.
But it doesn't say that.
That falls
under the TCCC, again, TCCC didn't exist back then. TCCC came out after 9/11 and right before Afghanistan and all that kicked off.
So I would have to look into that, because now we're talking about cut downs and chest tubes and finger thoracostomies, and all we're talking scope, not necessarily training. Or I could teach a TECC course, it's only 16 hours. So most TCCC courses are 16 hours per an AEMT curriculum, which
correct.
Is a far cry from 40 hours.
Correct. But the full TCCC course, it says it on their certificate how many hours it is.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll take a TCCC course that is the full course, not just a 16-hour course. That's a first aid course. That's basic first aid that they used to teach in the military. They just changed the name of it.
Yeah.
So I will tell you now, starting since the last 2 years, DOD, now everybody that's on the medical side in DOD, if they take a TCCC course, they come out holding a EMT basic National Registry certification. That's a requirement for TCCC. That is a DOD requirement.
So what we're looking for is basically a recognized entity who issues a certification.
Correct.
And we're not limited to American Red Cross or, no. or ASHI. But do they even need to be in there as those entities, but just something along the lines of through a recognized entity and get a certification out of it?
Correct. Because I know you guys, and I talk about Canada, because looking at Canada's medical training, everything that they say is equivalent to us. So if you're an EMT basic in Canada, you receive probably about 200 hours more training in Canada than you do in the United States for EMT basic. So there's a whole lot of different stuff that we have to look into and all that other stuff. And people start talking about medical training and we have to dig down to what the equivalent is. There's a lot of research that goes into it. And I'm not saying anything to those guys, but one thing I would like to mention about, you know, if you guys thinking about this and what the requirement is, I want to remind you of the state law that the governor that got passed, not this last legislative session, but the one before, about creating barriers to employment for veterans and stuff like that. So I just want to remind you of that. So.
Well, that's informative, but how would we apply that to here? So where the barriers that they're talking about?
Well, if you're going to say that they have to be a basic or above just the whole certification, that's creating a barrier.
We can't make a rule so restrictive that somebody coming back from the military can't get certified. That's what that means. If we do, we're in violation of state law.
Okay. So let me ask you, since you have a lot of experience in determining what's deemed qualified, just to get rid of the arbitrary nature of courses that may or may not change, would it serve the commission in their process of certifying people if we were to just say the training requirement must be medical training deemed equivalent by the commission and maybe coming up with what's your process for determining whether that training is equivalent or not?
Well, that's a hard question to answer because we very rarely get anything that goes off to the left or the right when people submit their medical training. It's either usually National Registry, it's either DOD, or it's Canada, or it's ASHI. We've never got anything from anybody that says, I have medical training, that we've had to delve off into anything deeper and looking at it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So because since National Registry has taken over, they basically, across the United States and everywhere else, including DOD, National Registry has their hand in everything, and usually when somebody hands us something from that portion, we know it's equivalent because it's the same across the board.
So would it make sense to just remove specific courses and just limit it to medical training equivalent to X, whatever that is, and then give it back to the commission? Because what I want to avoid is anything in here that creates a process for the commission determining what's available.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we need to codify that, but I'm definitely in favor of getting rid of the arbitrary.
Yeah, and the nice thing about it is we have a good working relationship with the IFSAC Accreditation Board in Canada, which there's more than one, but we talk to, there's mainly kids that come from the main parts of like Ontario and stuff like that. We have a good relationship with them that whenever they change something, they're medical, they update something, they'll tell us. But we've never known them to downgrade anything or anything. It's always, they've always added more and more on top of everything else. And it's the same way here too. We know they've never downgraded a certification or anything like that. They just added more to it. It's just that sometimes we'll get thrown a bone or something. If somebody comes from a different state and they just give us their state certification and it doesn't say that it's national, it's National Registry, anything like that, we may have to go back and look at theirs. But 99.9% of the time, most states have gone to the National Registry curriculum. It's those guys that come out from out of state, like me, they're old and want to move and think they're still blowing the fire service. And they bring that, and so that's some of the stuff after the old stuff. The newer stuff, we don't have a problem with. So. I don't know if I answered your question.
You did, yes. Yep.
Sorry.
Any other questions?
On the medical? I've got a question on some other.
Yeah. If there's no questions on the medical, let's move farther into the document and see what else we have to address. Go ahead.
So the question I have, Cliff, now that you're up there, I'm sorry, before you go sit down and make yourself comfortable. The fire science and fire science technology, when they refer to college hours in regards to those subjects, I do know that when this was produced, I'm assuming that it was very clarified of what a fire science course actually was.
Where are you at?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. I guess we're getting into the intermediate, but it's going to help me understand this when we get into the intermediate side of it. But
is there a page number you're on?
423.5.
And 9? Okay. 9? And it's just going to help me clarify, going back to the basic, when we start talking about hours. And the question I have is that, you know, we've had, our service has become very diversified, and we're diversifying a lot of the options that we have for our firefighters to take different paths. And within that, you know, I was looking at what the state put out in regards to what is a fire science program that is accepted to be deemed as. And now you have nursing, engineering, public administration, public education. You have a lot of those. You know, even pharmacy now is one of those. It's considered a fire science program for reimbursements, 100% reimbursement from the state. How do we know what is a fire science hour? I know you guys probably get somebody's transcript, you go through a transcript, and you're trying to check those off, what is deemed a fire science course or what is not.
It's the way the college codes the course. Fire science courses are FIRS. Anything that is emergency management or emergency medicine is EMSA. So if it has an EMSA or a FIRS coding to it, or it'll say public administration is PA, if I remember right. I wish Pat was here because he'll probably throw something at me. But public administration is PAM, I think, is the way it's coded. There's a four codes. It's public administration management. So just like criminal justice, for people who have arson investigator, they have to have criminal justice, and it's CIRJ. So it's the way the college codes it, the way we take it and do it. So.
Are we at the point now where we should probably look at a little bit more where, regardless of the college hours a person's coming in with, as long as they have college hours, being that we're becoming very diversified? I'll give you an example. Let's say an ag. Ag is not a person with an ag degree. He may not qualify for a fire science course. But now we've got ag rescue. We've got large animal rescue. We have those areas of our service now that those are type of people that become very beneficial within the fire service. But they don't have hours, per se, that translate into a fire science course. We have a lot of college-educated people here that get to the point where they can't get their upgrades because their college degree does not classify as a fire science course. But those guys and gals done education. They've set in colleges to acquire it, accredited to college to get those hours. We should value that in our service. I think we are now having a lot of people that are getting hired, and we're marketing those college-educated folks to hopefully join our business. And so, you know, to require someone to have hours in a certain area of fire science or fire technology, I don't know if we're at the point where, as long as somebody has college hours, it becomes very simple to say he's got accredited college hours. As a commission, we're not in there looking at transcripts trying to determine, is it criminal justice, is it public, and because now that they've added even a pharmacy now is considered a fire science program, I think it's a lot of work on the back end that has to happen at y'all's office to where if a person's college educated, he or she is college educated. That's what I was thinking.
Well, let me jump in. One, staff's not going to answer that question for you.
Okay.
We're not allowed to have an opinion. But I think it'd be a great conversation for you guys to have with the commissioners, and be ready, because what you will hear is kind of what we just talked about on the medical side. We're here for the fire service, the betterment of the fire service. We don't really care about everything else. We're here for the fire service. And the other thing you'll hear, that when you get into higher levels, we all come from systems where higher levels equals incentive pays. This agency's not here to help somebody make more money. We're here to make sure you have the education you need to be a firefighter. So that's going to have, that's going to be a never-ending debate that has gone on for years and will continue. And I'm not saying not to do it. I'm just saying that's not for, that staff's not going to answer that. We're not allowed to have an opinion on that. That's a debate that needs to happen between the fire service and the commissioners. We recognize college-identified fire technology training through their degree program. That's what we recognize, period. If the college says it goes for their fire degree, we accept it. It's not up to us to take pharmacy or cosmetology or ag or anything else. And staff's not even, we're not even allowed to have that opinion. So we can't answer that. I think that's a conversation that needs to occur with the fire service in general and the commissioners.
If there was a process to add Vince's concern, those specific classes he's referring to,
you're in it.
To the A and B, A and B list, would that be the route that would be appropriate?
Well, the A and B list, that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, those are...
We don't have enough time here today, and you're only scheduled for one day.
Right.
But I think it takes us back to, you don't have to send this back to them immediately.
Right.
You'll sit on it and do a lot of research. But, and I don't want to sound like a dinosaur, but I think Reedy will support me on this. These conversations have occurred for years, and they get pretty deep. Right. The medical conversation in 1995 lasted for a year and a half. All right. These high levels of certification conversations, they go on for months and months and months.
A year and a half, did y'all solve it or did you give up on it?
You read and you don't like what it says. So
right.
That was 25, 30 years ago too. So what I'm saying is we're the fire commission. We're focused on firefighters and education of firefighters. We start going down all these other rabbit trails, we're going to have some lengthy meetings. And I'm all good with that. We just don't have the time here today, and we can't answer the question that Vince just asked.
Yeah, and I think I wasn't asking, when you say answer, I was just kind of trying to get the interpretation. I think a college hour is a college hour, and when somebody comes in our business that is college educated, you know, we're trying to spend time, what is this deemed appropriate or not to be giving him or her that extra, those hours to be classified as. I think we, in our world now today, we need to value, or I think, the value of a person's college degree, regardless of what it is.
I'm not going to agree or disagree. All we can go by is what the rule says, and the rule limits us to whatever the college identifies as fire training.
Can I offer a different perspective?
Excuse me?
Can I offer a different perspective?
We're here to discuss.
So my concern is that, if I'm understanding you correctly, that we essentially accept credit for anything whenever it comes specifically to obtaining advanced certifications, advanced levels of certification. I think it's the way it's designed with multiple options and specifically relating to fire protection technology and those types of degrees is appropriate because it's advancing that particular certification. I think there are routes for acknowledging their accomplishments educationally, but for these certification processes, I absolutely understand where you're coming from to give them credit and acknowledge that, but I don't want to water down the training and the intent of the requirements for the advanced level certifications. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
It does also, but like if you go out there, they say a different agency, and you get, there's a lot of guys that go get their education, but they come out of CEUs, right? Or the clock hours. There's like a TEKS, they have clock hours when you go take a class. That's very hard, and especially in the region where I work at. A lot of them, clock hours don't turn over to semester hours. You have to go through like a whole PLA or different process, and I get that part, but I'm just saying sometimes when you go take outside classes to continue further your education, the semester hours is an issue also, though, to convert those clock hours, those specific hours, into semester hours as stated here on the rule here. Because you go down to TEKS, take a class, they're considered clock hours, not considered
semester hours. Correct. Training program.
Correct.
College program.
Correct. So you go out there and still get educated in that particular subject, but you're not converting over to college hours, and that's just a whole different program itself.
Is that training an A and B list course?
Yeah. It's yes or no, I guess. I mean, it's very different because even when you take, like, the training academies, a lot of them are not affiliated with a college, or they are. It's hard to convert those back. They give them to you as CEU hours. And to convert that over, it is an issue, I guess, that I've been approached to by different agencies itself. So
I guess I want to ask a question. I think we're convoluting two different things.
Yeah.
What the rule talks about, and the question originated from Vince about the college education requirement. But now what I'm hearing is we're talking about just training in general. And what the rule doesn't allow, you can't use your fire officer training to count towards your college education. You have to be pursuing a degree. And all this stems from the 90s when college was the thing. Everybody had to have college. And it took me another 20 years to get a piece of paper to hang on the wall that means absolutely nothing. But I couldn't take all those other certs that I had and all those higher levels that I had in my different certifications and count it towards that. And so originally it said 3 hours, 9 hours, or I'm sorry, 3 hours, 6 hours, or nine. Then we changed it to 4, 8, and 12. It took 2 years of debate to add that 1 hour to each one of these levels, intermediate, advanced, and master. And what kept coming back was the same thing that's happening here. And I mean, this is all healthy and great, but it's making me feel old because I see different faces having the same discussion. You gotta maintain separation between the individual getting a college degree versus the individual just chasing certificates and incentive pays. Right. That's where we have to be careful. That's what I'm trying to say. We gotta be cognizant of that. And I think Daniel said the same thing. Let's don't convolute the hour requirement. We're only asking for 4 hours of college. That's two college classes over a 4 year period to get it. You know, 9 hours, 12 hours, whatever. It's a number of hours. To get master, you have to have 60 hours of college, and it has to be towards fire science, however the college identifies that. But you can't use your ARF and your EMT and all of that for that time. What you can use is colleges now are allowing, they'll give you college hours, they'll transfer your clock hours to college hours for your basic fire academy or for your EMT, and you're allowed to use that towards the college hour count. What you can't use are your other certifications you may gain through here towards that. It's just the way the system's set up. Not necessarily ours, the college system is set up that way.
I don't want to step on Jim's or Mike's toes.
I didn't get a chance yet.
But to build on what Mike is saying, you have to talk to your institution of higher learning to figure out what goes, because there are colleges in the state of Texas, community colleges are more the ones that are doing it, that will give you block time conversions for certain certifications that you hold with TCFB, but you have to talk to them. We can't be that specific in our rules about that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, you're correct.
So, but you just have to talk to your institution of higher learning.
It's based on ACE hours.
Go ahead, Jim.
Mr. Chairman, I think, Jim Lee for the TSAFF, I think that this is going to be a great discussion at the next meeting because you guys already have a couple of pretty deep issues, and I think as you finish and go through all the rest of the issues that everybody has, I'd say it sounds like a really good agenda item that will allow a lot more research between now and then. So mm-hmm. I think that all the points are excellent. And WSCO, we probably have to allow a little more time for this when it gets posted.
Yeah. I can see the next meeting being a two-day meeting. Mm-hmm. And this is good. This is exactly what...
This is how it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is how it's supposed to be. But there is a lot of antiquated language in there, and a lot of antiquated, only because it's from that IFSAC period. I remember that too, and it's a long time coming, and it needed to be done. So that's all I would say is everybody make notes, and that way everybody can be prepared for the next meeting to make some recommendations. I don't think the commissioners will fault anyone at all for wanting to take a really deep dive into this. So,
okay.
I think it'll make their day, actually, because I think they like this. I mean, this is what they're looking for.
It's why we exist.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, Vince, are you okay to move on from there?
I mean,
we make the notes. We'll come back to this. I mean, okay. I think this is worth visiting, and it'll give you more time and the rest of us more time to vet that out.
Okay.
To maybe talk to some other stakeholders to get a feel from the commissioners. I don't see this going to an ad hoc committee of some sort as a recommendation, but we have that authority to do that now.
Absolutely.
But what else as we move to? We're just talking about 423.5.
I'm curious,
and excuse my ignorance, how often are these A-list and these B-list courses updated, and who updates them?
He just fled the room.
We got something else going on with staff. And A-list and B-list are ongoing. They're consistently being updated, and most of it is derived from whatever the NFA is doing and what's put out there is what classes they're teaching and what other college programs are doing. It's an ongoing issue, and I can tell you in the almost 5 years I've been in this job, we've never gotten ahead of it. We're constantly working to catch up and keep that up to date. It's an ongoing effort. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but that's the reality of it.
I understand.
We hadn't ever caught up.
We're always chasing curriculum. I get it.
Well, what I would ask from this committee is by our next meeting, we should all understand what those A and B lists are, how they're managed, how change is affected when we move forward in time, how we got to where we are. So being that we're going to be tabling this, obviously, to the next meeting, maybe give us a little more time to do a little more homework, talk to staff, talk to previous members of this committee, and then do the research ourselves so we can come up with a solution or a proposal on all of that. Moving on from 423.5, is there anything else here in 423 that anybody else wants to talk about or address? Did anybody see anything else that was contradictory or outdated or needed to be?
Well, and really, I'll say just the two or three areas we've touched already will have an impact on all the rest of it.
Yeah. Right.
Your question, I didn't see anything else beyond that.
Okay. All right, anything else in 423 then that we're worth discussing? So we don't have a motion on the table at all, so other than the discussion, so in order to take some action, we'll need to have a motion made.
Does anybody make a motion to table that?
You're making a motion to table? Yes, all right. So Shane Parker's making the motion to table this to our next meeting. Are you also suggesting that we kick this off to the commissioners to at least update them on that so that they'll know what we're talking about? Their meeting will be before our next meeting.
To inform them, yes, sir.
Yeah, that's my responsibility to do that. Okay, so I have a motion from Shane to table 423.
Second.
Daniel Anderson is seconding it. Any other discussions? No discussions. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, so moved. So we will table.
We already made some notes. We're going to start researching a few things from the staff side, and I think at your next meeting we can take all that and start coming up with some recommendations to move forward.
Okay.
And I wouldn't be surprised if there's not some discussion at the commission meeting when you tell them.
Well, I would hope so. I'm going to try to instill a little discussion from them.
No, I think that's most appropriate. I mean, well, it tells them you're doing exactly what they ask you to do, too. We get some insight from
them. Right.
All right. Okay. Item number 5, discussion and possible action on the rule review of 37 Texas Administrative Code, Chapter 425, Fire Service Instructors.
Okay. This one's a little shorter.
Yep.
Provided the first questions y'all ask. It's shorter in pages, but... have you guys had an opportunity to review this, to ask anything that is of concern? No.
I will add that your previous discussions, again, could have some impact to this as we move forward, just as a point of reference.
Yeah, because
at least as long as we're here, do we have any discussion items that we could specifically point in on, other than waiting till how 423 plays out? Because I agree, 423, depending on how that is adopted, will impact 425.
I think it's safe to say, with that understanding, probably need to table this one as well until we get further clarification on 423. So I'll make a motion to table this as we venture forth Okay. More clarification on 423.
I have a motion from Shane Parker to table 425 as well. I'll entertain a second.
Second.
Okay. I have a second. From Robert. Any other discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Chief Wiska, also just maybe with your staff, as long as we're going to be circling back to this, and being that we have such a new new membership of our, and our next meeting will have even more new members. On 425.1 under D, where it talks about an out-of-state military or federal instructor training program may be accepted by the commission.
Okay.
If we could have somebody from your staff maybe explain how that would look. I don't have any question with it at all. I just think that, we have a board here that may not be familiar with what that even means.
Sure. And that's probably a good time to go into the state law about impediments or barriers and things like that.
I would like to know more about that as well, for sure. So I'm going to at least make a note on that, that if we could get staff to circle back at the next meeting just to help educate. I think maybe based on that information, we may and may not have questions about that stuff. Okay, so 425 has been tabled as well. I'll be taking both of these items to the commission at their next meeting to let them know that they'll be still working on it. And also, I may be out of line to go so far as, depending on how this plays out, this would probably have a lot of impact on other rules as well.
I think it will. But I mean, I applaud you guys for bringing it up because I Jim said it, a lot of this stuff is antiquated. A lot of the rules are. But this rule right here, 423 more than any of them, drives everything else in the book. So it certainly warrants a thorough review and maybe even some update.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Item number six, subjects for future agenda items.
I think we got two.
And then also we'll be doing the new member orientation as well on the next meeting with the two new members.
I do have a question on that. Does the training that we're doing, does that cover whatever statutory requirement we have for, or if we have one for open meetings?
No, that's completely different. But the existing members should already have that. We'll double check that. If we need to do that again, we'll send you the link. I know we sent it to the newest members, and they're all knocking it out if they haven't already. But we'll check and see if we need to redo y'all's.
All right.
So I got 423, 425, the new member training, obviously.
I'm forgetting something, aren't I?
No, because we got through the election thing. We worked that out. So we're not going to do that. I don't know if there's anybody in the audience that might have something. But
do you see the next meeting be more than one day with the content?
Well, when we get to number seven, I'm going to probably make a suggestion that we could schedule it for two. We don't have to use both. But if we schedule it, that gives you that opportunity to dive into this more.
My recommendation.
I can tell you there's been days in the past we had 2 and 3 day meetings. I mean, back when early on, and I could see real quick how we get to that when we get into some of these big rules like this.
Okay.
I think a lot of things, but depending on how the commission wants to weigh in as well, and any of the research we do between now and then. But to Chief's point, I think if we at least booked out 2 days. We may very well knock it out in a half of a day and be done, but at least we got prepared.
If we post it that way, there's no problem with spilling over into another day. Whereas if it's not posted that way, we can't do that. So never a problem with booking more than one day. We just have to have that on the meeting agenda and the posting.
Right, and we also don't know what will happen between now and February that the commission will throw on us.
We don't know what else might get vetted down to you guys.
Yeah, I was looking at in the essence of travel arrangements for our Department of Affairs. Yeah, so as soon as we know, and if it's scheduled for 2 days, and we already said it, it'll allow us to start the travels for those.
Sure. Well, when you get to the next agenda item, we're going to talk about meetings extensively, so we can come back to that.
Yes, sir.
Okay, any other agenda items?
All right.
Item number seven.
Hold on, and to Deere's point, there could be more come from the commissioners.
Yes.
So you might get an agenda that's got more than just three things on it, and don't let that surprise you.
All right, item number seven, future meeting dates.
So we were discussing those a little bit.
Yeah, so let me start off with a little explanation of this process for everybody's benefit. The commissioners have set their meetings for all of 25, and I want to give you guys those dates just so you have them. But it has a big impact on your meeting dates. So the commissioners are meeting February. They'll have a workshop on the 19th, and they'll have a regular meeting on the 20th. After that, they'll have a meeting on May 15th. Then you get to August. They'll have a workshop on August the 20th and a meeting on August 21st. And then in November, they will have a meeting on November the 20th. So that's important because staff has a huge burden when it comes to managing the scheduling of this room and putting together agendas and making sure that assignments from the commission get to the right committees and all that. So we had a hard time this time because the commission meeting was November the 20th. I think that's right. And you guys are here on December the 5th. And there are posting requirements. So we had two business days. We had a Friday and a Monday to get the agenda set for your meeting with everything that the commissioners wanted to send to you and get that posted to the register. So as we move into 25, we have a goal of trying to better manage that, knowing that we've got three committees and the commissioners, as well as ad hoc committees that are working for CNT that we have to schedule and make sure there's staff and room and all that available. So typically, the Fireball Advisory Committee has been on a meeting rotation of March, June, September, and December. We would like to stay with that, number one. And number two, we spend a lot of time balancing these meeting dates around other things that happen. So unfortunately, all these meetings are in Austin. Austin's a tough place to get to. Austin's a tough place to get hotels in because there's so many things going on. For the 2025, for the first part of 25, you're dealing with the legislature being in town, which fills up all the hotels. And that's not to mention any special events that take place that bring hundreds of thousands of people to town. So I've got some meeting date recommendations, and I would really like to schedule out all four of your meetings, or all of your meetings for 25, keeping in mind that if we get to March and somebody has a conflict or we see some issue and you need to change the date for June or September or something, that's still on the table. But it's going to be very helpful to us to try to manage all of this if we know the whole year meeting calendar in place. So if it's all right with the chairman, I want to throw some dates at you guys for March. We'll do the same thing for June, September, all that, and we'll just go from there. I mean, it's your choice, but I'm going to throw some dates at you that we've researched, that we know would work, that the room's available. Should be hotels available at best. So, I mean, there's a lot of moving pieces here. So, for March, I would ask you to look at March 20th or March the 27th. Keeping in mind the legislature, spring break, the motorcycle rally that's in March, and soccer games and other things that take place. So
I think NASCAR is coming here too in March.
Yeah. So there's a lot going on in March in the city, which has an impact on where you're going to be able to find a place to lay your head at night, in particular if we go for 2 days. Now, I threw those dates at you because I researched those dates. Now, thinking about if you wanted to schedule a 2-day meeting in case we need that, those are Thursdays that I gave you, so you need to either look at Wednesday, Thursday, or Thursday, Friday. We don't have a preference. I hate meeting on Friday, but we don't have a preference. Yeah. So, I mean, as we're starting to look at this, let's look at all of that.
So I've talked to a couple of members of the committee on those dates. I know the 20th for some school districts, that's still kind of in the spring break window.
Right,
so my suggestion would be that very last week,
does anybody have a problem with maybe setting aside the 26th and 27th? Now, just so y'all know, I'm going to push as much as we can that we get it done in one day.
Sure.
I'm going to, matter of fact, I'll probably ask that we start the meeting at 9 instead of 10.
Yep.
Does anybody have a problem with that? Because we're going to need
26, 27 works for me.
Yeah, that's fine with me. That's good.
Sounds good.
Okay. Anybody, you guys as well?
Good for me.
All right, so we'll look at the 26th and 27th.
With a 9 a.m. start.
And we're at a 9 a.m. start.
Okay.
And I say that, well, so I have up until 10 days before then to actually adjust that time, correct?
Yeah, by law. We try to get it in sooner than
that. Well, the reason I say that is depending on how the commission meeting goes,
sure.
if it looks like we can knock it all out and just 4 or 5 hours, then I might stay with the 10 o'clock time.
We'll start building our agenda. Actually, we'll start building it now, but we'll tighten it up right after the commission meeting, and then right. That's when I send it to you, and we go back and forth with Frank and all that. So there's an opportunity to manipulate that time if you see a need for it.
If you don't mind putting a TBD on that for now, I think we'll make a decision after that commission meeting. Because for the folks that do have to drive in that morning, I don't want to have them on the road so early. So we're looking at the 26th and 27th of March. Got it.
You ready to talk about June?
Yes, sir.
All right. So the Thursdays that are available in June with everything going on, is June the 12th or June the 26th?
So once again, having talked to a few of you guys, it seemed like more of you were leaning towards the 12th than the 26th. Getting a little too far into the summer, a little too close to July 4th. Unless somebody else has heartburn with that. Does the 12th sound good?
12th is better for me.
12th is better for you? 12th is good for you, Ty?
Yep.
You, Robin?
Yes.
Shane, how about you?
The 12th sounds great.
Ben?
12th for me would be kind of hard, but I think I'd make it work.
What about you, Antonio?
Yeah, we'll go and try that.
All right.
It's going to be a one day, though, right?
Well, maybe. We don't know, but for right now, we'll set it for the 12th. Once again, to Chief Wisco's, we're trying to get this on the calendar.
Correct.
It may play out just like that, but it's not carved in stone. If worst case scenario, we have to stretch it to 2 days, we'll do that.
Would you be objective if I go ahead and block out on the calendar the 11th and the 12th, just in case we get to that point? I mean, we're not going to post this for a long time, but just we'll go ahead and mark it out on our calendar so we can keep from having any other conflicts.
Well, if y'all would block your 11th and 12th, but we're going to try to do our best to have it on the 12th and get it all done in one day. But being that it's 7 months from now, a lot can change. So, and to your point, Chief, I'd rather go Wednesday, Thursday than a Thursday, Friday.
Okay. Well, we appreciate that. September. September's probably been the hardest one so far, but September 25th was about the best date when you balance football games and rallies and everything else that's going on.
Does anybody have huge heartburn?
I know we're getting a long way out at this point, but.
Anybody good with the 25th?
I'm good.
All right, we'll go with the 25th.
And then December 11th. Everybody knows December and what that looks like, so.
So I've talked to a couple of other members of this committee. You were looking at the 11th. Is the 4th still an option?
At this point, I don't see why not. I
mean, so you had mentioned the commission meeting's the 20th.
Commission meeting's the 20th.
So does that leave with Thanksgiving in between?
It'll be a hard turnaround as far as getting it posted. I prefer not to do the 4th, but there's nothing that says it.
Because a few of us were talking, trying to wrap up the year before the holidays, and the 11th is getting a little closer to Christmas. So, what are your thoughts?
I'm good for either.
Yeah,
I've
got no objection to either 4th or the 11th.
If we did the 4th with a promise of getting all the information to you guys, matter of fact, I'll be so bold as to say, if you'll pin me down at the end of the commission meeting, we can hammer it out before I walk out the room to get that agenda so that that's not a time constraint.
Well, I bet by the time we get there, we'll all forget before the Yazzie will, but by the time we get there, we could have that agenda ready.
Right.
Minus whatever maybe they add that day, and we can pencil that in, and we can have that conversation before you even leave here after their meeting that day. We can make that work. And again, we're a year out now, so who knows what's going to happen. All right. So the fourth right now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. We appreciate that. That gives us a chance now. We can work with the other two committees and the subcommittees and everything else that's going on, too. So right now that we have some dates.
Now that we have all these committees fully up and running come January 1st, I think we could visit this halfway through the year and see where we're at.
Yeah, without a doubt.
All right. Item number 8, adjourned meeting.
I will entertain a motion if anybody has one.
Make a motion to adjourn.
Okay, Antonio.
Second.
Seconded by Daniel Anderson. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, so moved. It is now 12:19. We'll call the meeting adjourned. Thank you, everybody. Happy holidays to everybody.